WCBS, WCBS HD, and WCBS FM HD2, New York.
You're listening to a special presentation. I'm listening, New York.
With Madison, it happened so fast. If it can happen to her, it can happen to anybody. And it is not something to be ashamed of.
It's a sign of strength to get help, not weakness.
During my career, I don't know who I would have reached out to.
Just asking and being honest and truthful and being there to listen, I think, is a big starting point.
Hey, Christine, why are we doing this radio takeover of your station, Alt-92.3, and mine, WCBS, and every single 235 intercom radio stations right now?
Hey, Wayne. So why we're doing this is to end the stigma of talking about mental health, to make all of us more aware of the signs of suicide, and really to normalize these kind of conversations. That's the goal. And before we go any further with our local I'm Listening segment, here is a way that you can get help right now. The National Suicide Prevention Lifeline is 1-800-273-TALK. That's 1-800-273-8255. You can go to imlistening.org for more information about what we're doing today, and you can use the hashtag #imlistening to share your stories.
Identifying depression and helping before it's too late. This is an EntercomRadio.com special. I'm Listening. I'm Wayne Cabot.
And my name's Christine Malavetz. 5 years ago, a young woman from northern New Jersey, a beloved family member, loyal friend, and talented athlete, took her own life at 19. Her story made national news and sadly showed us that almost everyone is facing a struggle that you can't see from the outside. Today, the Madison Hollerin Foundation keeps her memory alive and works towards suicide prevention. Maddie's sister, Carly Bushoven, is with us today.
Hi, Carly.
Hi, how are you guys?
You're brave to do this, I have to say.
Oh, thank you. I enjoy doing it. It helps me remember Madison and, you know, keep her memory alive, like Christine said. And I enjoy helping people. I do kind of talks like all over the country now at schools and community events and wherever they'll have me. And I just really enjoy it. I feel like a lot of people get a lot out of it and like to hear Madison's story because she wasn't really the typical person you would think would be depressed or suicidal. So
she was 19 years old.
She was, yes.
And had just turned 19.
Yes.
And was an Ivy League student.
Yes.
Going to Penn.
Yes.
A dream of hers.
Yeah.
Major scholar, major athlete, maybe the best female athlete in New Jersey at the time, wouldn't you say?
I would say, yeah.
And she had everything going for her. And there's so many people like that who seem to have it all together. And then there's something we're not seeing.
Right.
How do we reconcile ourselves with the fact that people who on the outside have it all going on sometimes are missing something on the inside? And how do we know this? How do we find out and help them?
I think it's important to just have a real conversation, whether it be with your kids, your friends, your teammates. Talk to them and ask the question, and don't be afraid to ask the questions. The book, What Made Maddie Run, that Kate wrote about Madison and her story, I think is a great conversation starter. And I've heard that from a lot of people who don't know how to go up to their friends or their kids or their parents and have this real conversation. You can maybe hand them the book and say, you know, I kind of related to this, or do you relate to this? Just asking and being honest and truthful and being there to listen, I think, is a big starting point. And it shows people that you care and that you're willing to be there for them.
My first introduction to Maddie's story was through the initial article that Kate had written, which she titled Split Image.
Right.
And a lot of that article talked about the juxtaposition between the public life that so many of us show on social media platforms and the private life that only we know is real. So at this point, 5 years later, how do you feel about the relationship between social media and mental health? Because there is a relationship there.
Oh, for sure. And I think that Kate definitely hit the nail on the head with that one. I remember Madison coming home for Thanksgiving break, and my mom knew that she was depressed and having problems at school. And she said to her, you know, but Madison, look at all these pictures. Like, you look so happy. You're at these parties with all your friends. You're smiling. You look like you're having a great time. And Madison told my mom, it's just a picture. Instagram especially, but all social media, it's just the highlights. It's not the whole picture. because I do think that Madison also had trouble seeing that, like, oh, all my friends look like they're so happy at school and they're having the best time and they're really enjoying college. Why is that not me?
After reading that story, I changed my profile on a few of my platforms to say these are the highlights, not the whole story. Because as someone,
I noticed that on yours.
Yeah, because it really did strike me, especially because Madison's story resonates for so many of us who felt like we couldn't be honest about what we were feeling, perhaps out of fear that it would hurt the people we love or maybe scare or frighten them. And in thinking we were protecting those people, right, we were actually not being honest with them. And that was a difficult realization for me as someone who struggled with the type of transitions that Madison did, to realize that in that attempt to protect the people I loved, I wasn't actually being honest with them, which is why I'm listening is so important to all of us here at Entercom, because it's encouraging people to have those conversations and to reinforce that the people who love you want to hear the real you.
Yes. I remember me, my sisters, we were all so upset, of course, after it happened. But, you know, we were like, why didn't she tell us? Why wasn't she more honest with us? Like, we would have been there in a second if she told us that she was having suicidal thoughts, or even that she was depressed and, like, didn't think she could go to school anymore. I mean, we knew that she was suffering and that she wasn't her same self. We definitely didn't know that suicide was ever an option or a possibility. And I do think that that was Madison's way of kind of protecting us and sheltering us in a way. She didn't want us to have to suffer or go through anything like she was going through. And she's always kind of been that way. She's been more introverted, especially when it comes to her true feelings. I knew that growing up, I knew that she was like that as a person. She always kind of wanted to be the happy, bubbly, you know, I'll put a smile on your face type of person. So
it's a big load to carry.
It is. It really is. She was definitely a high achiever. And I think that you see that a lot in high achievers, is that they hold a lot of their true feelings inside. They don't want to be a burden to other people. They just want to keep pushing themselves. And I think that Madison definitely fit that description.
You know, looking back when she said, Mom, it's just a picture, talking about her Instagram.
Yeah.
In retrospect, we can, in so many situations with our loved ones, beat ourselves up for possibly missing things. But really, when people are going through adolescence or the transition from high school into college, or really any time in their lives, you go through so many different mood swings, and especially adolescence, hormonal changes, just moodiness. There's really no way to filter out just the typical average moody kid from somebody who's going through depression, or is there?
You know, that is hard, because if you look at a lot of people, when I do my talks or I talk about the foundation or Madison's story, a lot of them, that's like the main question I get. You know, what are the signs? What do we look out for? Because parents, I mean, they're terrified, obviously, and they want to be able to help in any way that they can. But like you said, I mean, being tired, being moody, I mean, that could be depression or that could be the average teenager. So it is hard to tell a difference. That's why I think it's just so important to sit your kids down and tell them, you know, I'm here for you. If you ever want to talk about this, if you think you need to take a break from athletics, from school, if you just want to take a mental health day, it's important to know that you're there from them, and that you are willing to have that conversation with them, and you're willing to listen to them and give them a break that they might need. Because I think a lot of kids are just so nervous and scared to tell their friends and their parents that they are feeling this way, especially because they probably think it makes them look weak. And I know my dad is a big proponent of that. When he goes out and talks about the foundation, he's like, you know, admitting that you are suffering or that you have a mental illness or that you might be depressed is the farthest thing from weak. It makes you brave and it makes you strong, and your family and your friends, you would be surprised to see how much they rally around you and would be there to help you.
Your dad, as I recall from the book, didn't want to discuss the fact that your sister was having, towards the end, some suicidal thoughts. She admitted in therapy, because your dad didn't want her to focus on that part of it, didn't want to make it come true.
Yeah.
That's understandable.
I think it was just terrifying as a parent. I didn't know at the time that she was having suicidal thoughts. My parents did, so they got her into therapy immediately. And they tried to help her in any way that they could. I think with Madison, it happened so fast. She went to school at the end of August, early September, and she died in January. So I think with a lot of kids, you always think, oh, well, if they're depressed, I'll get them into therapy. I'll help them. I'll get them medication. It's a long, drawn-out process of getting help, of trying to heal. And with Madison in particular, it just happened so fast. We want to make that clear to people that time is not always on your side. So if you do know that somebody's suffering, get them help immediately, get them to a therapist, a counselor, a psychiatrist, whatever you can, and don't leave their side. Once they're showing that they have suicidal thoughts, it's important not to leave them alone for really any amount of time.
And it does seem striking when you lay that timeline out, how quickly everything happened. We do live in a world where everything goes. It seems exponentially faster every year. And in that rush of multitasking and keeping up with the world around you, it's difficult to slow down and remember that feelings aren't facts, which I think is one of those things we can teach our children early to understand how to label their feelings and identify them and understand that they're part of you. They're not this scary other. They're part of you. And when you look at them and you share them with people, they become a lot less terrifying and a lot more temporary.
Yeah, especially with Madison. And I think a lot of people, when depression comes out and anxiety comes out and it comes on so quickly, they don't know how to identify it, like you were saying. So with Madison, she kept saying, something's not right. I don't feel right. I don't feel like myself. But she never used the word depression or anxiety or whatever it might be. She just kept telling us something's not right. So I think that's a big indicator too. You know, like your friends, your kids, whoever it might be, may not come up to you and use those exact words. They may not say, I am depressed or I feel depressed. They may just say something like, I don't feel right, or something is wrong. And I think you need to be aware of that and looking out for that as well.
Well, what do you do, though, when a friend says, something doesn't feel right, I'm just not feeling right? What's the next step? As a friend, I mean, you want to respect someone's privacy to a point, and yet you want to be there to be their soundboard and to help them. It's like, how far do you go?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. I think it's hard for a lot of people to know the answer to that, and it's different for every person. But I think that that friend took that first step in telling you that something's not right. They are reaching out and they want help. And privacy may be important, but it's not as important as their life or getting them back onto the road to mental recovery. So I would do anything that I could in that moment and try and help them in any way that I could.
And a lot of times we encourage people, like the name of I'm Listening, that, you know, we oftentimes tell people it's okay for you to come to us if you're feeling something. But we can also be proactive with our friends, let them know before there's a crisis, right? Because of how quickly things can move when you are in crisis, to create an environment with our family and friends and peers that they know you are a safe place, and to ask and to check in. Because sometimes when it's apparent that something is wrong, we're already so far down that path. And so it's important. And that's why, Carly, we're so grateful that you're so willing to have these conversations, because these are the base that we're building to have stronger, healthier, more compassionate conversations about mental health before we get to a point where it's too late.
Right. And I think you kind of hit the nail on the head there. I mean, a lot of people will not come forward and talk about it, even if it's a physical illness. You know, sometimes people don't even want to talk about it until it's almost too late, or until it's gotten to an extreme point. So yeah, I think creating that safe space, letting those around you know that you're there, you are listening, and you can and will do anything you can to help them in that time of need is important, so that they know that there is a safe space.
I think the stigma really is being lifted. I don't want to be too Pollyanna about it, but I really think that's happening. The mayor of New York City just came out and talked about his father's suicide when Bill de Blasio was 18, because the father was suffering what we now know as PTSD from World War II. Mm. That was something nobody would ever talk about. It was family secret, family shame, and now we know it's not shame. It's reality. We're all dealing with certain levels of this, and we all have experiences, and it's not something to fear putting out there. Quite the opposite. It's what will save your life and the lives of others. Your foundation, your sister's foundation, does exactly that. Am I right?
Yeah. I mean, I think we have come so far in the 5 years just since Madison died. We have tried to end the stigma, like you say, and just talk about it. And I think that's really the first step, sharing Madison's story, letting people know that if it can happen to her, it can happen to anybody. And it is not something to be ashamed of. You know, so many people today suffer, and our foundation just wants people to know that and know that there's help and that there's a way to get help and talk about it. We work with other organizations like the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention. They're right here in New York City. City. They do a great job doing overnight walks. And we also work with Active Minds. They're another organization that are on college campuses, which is, I mean, really near and dear to our heart because that's where Madison went and kind of suffered and couldn't really get the help that she needed. In 2016, the Madison-Hollerin suicide prevention law was actually passed in the state of New Jersey. There has to be around-the-clock care on college campuses for mental illness. So if you are suffering, you can see somebody at any time of day immediately if you feel like you need to. And I think that was huge for the state of New Jersey. We hope that it spreads to other states as well. Because Madison, you know, she went back to school. She was seeing a therapist at home. She went back to school and she was put on a 2-week waiting list. I think if she could have gotten into somebody immediately, could have gotten that help, could have talked to somebody and set up a relationship with a psychiatrist at school, that could have been a huge help for her. So we're really proud of that law being passed. Like I said, I go around, I do talks all over the country, just sharing her story and letting people know that your story doesn't have to end the same way as hers.
And as Maddie's sister, who has been working over the past 5 years to share her story, which I'm sure can be deeply painful at times to revisit as much as it is helpful to be able to help others.
Sure.
What have you learned about how to take care of yourself as a survivor of suicide loss?
You know, ever since Madison died, our family in general and my husband, his family, we've all just been, I think, very open and sharing. It scared us and it hurt us deeply to lose Madison. And I know as a family, none of us want to have to ever go through something like that again. So I know I turn to my husband sometimes. I'll be working on, you know, my speech or my presentation that I'm going to give at a school for the next day, the next week. And I try and get in bed and I can't turn my mind off. And that can be so hard. You know, it's such important work I feel like I'm doing and I love doing it and it is healing to me, but it can be hard to hear other people's stories and think of Madison's and share it. And it can be hard to shut that off at night sometimes. So I just take breaks. I learn to find what makes me happy, the joy in life, what makes me feel relaxed. So if I work on foundation stuff, if I'm working with suicide survivors, whatever it may be, and I need a break after that, then I go and I do what I need to do. I play with my kids. I go for a walk. I read a book. Whatever I can find that de-stresses me and makes me feel kind of myself again.
Because being able to take care of yourself, and all this goes for all of us, mm-hmm. enables you to take better care of other people.
Oh, 100%.
If we don't slow down and say, hey, and be able to identify our own feelings,
right,
then we don't have the capacity to take care of other people, which as parents, as family members, as friends is so important.
Yeah. And I just think the honesty, too, part of it is so important. Like I said, my family now, we're so honest and with our feelings. I think sometimes other people might find us a little weird because we're always like, well, this is how I'm feeling right now. And we just want to be able to make sure that we all are on the same page and we understand each other and what we're going through. And some of us are in therapy now. Some of us are on medication and we're not ashamed of that. I mean, it's where we need to be and what we need to do to be our healthy, normal selves. So we're doing what we need to do to take care of each other. And I think that's the most important thing.
You know, it's working too. You can feel good about saving at least one life. I'm reading on the website of a woman named Victoria.
Yeah.
Who wrote in to say, I read the story of Madison and I realized, my goodness, this is my story too. And you gave me the courage to seek the help that I needed.
Yeah.
So feel good about that.
Yeah, thank you. We're doing that now on the website and promoting it on our Facebook page. You know, share your story. I told Victoria when she reached out to me, I was like, you do not have to put your name on this. You know, this can be 100% anonymous. And she was like, no, this is part of why I want to share it. I want people to know my name and where I come from and who I am and that I was like Madison. She's at, you know, the University of Florida and playing tennis and she's doing amazing things and she looks like she has this wonderful life on the outside, but she suffered too. And I think it's important that so many people who relate to Madison feel that they can share their story now as well. Just because you're doing these amazing things and living this great life doesn't mean that you can't have a mental illness, doesn't mean that you can't be depressed or anxious.
And people, the pressure on perfectionists, especially.
Oh, yeah. And I think also it's important, Madison and Victoria and so many others who've reached out to me, these high achievers, that perfectionism, that pressure is coming from themselves. You know, they're their worst critic. Their family, from what I hear, their friends are so supportive once they find out. They love to be there for them and do anything they can to help. It's them who are putting that pressure on themselves and are trying their best to be number one and succeed. So that's another area where you have to identify it and be able to work on it, you know?
And learn to be kind to yourself.
Yes. Oh, that's huge. Yeah. I think Madison, like I said, put the most pressure on herself. She was her own worst critic. We were all her cheerleaders. You know, we thought that she was doing amazing, that she was doing great, and we couldn't be prouder of her. So, being able to identify it and being kind to yourself is so important.
Hey, aren't you guys going to bust me on what I said a minute ago? Carly and Christine? Maybe you didn't catch it. I caught myself.
Oh, no.
I used the phrase earlier when talking about the stigma, and there shouldn't be any. I used the phrase committed suicide, which I wasn't even aware, because I'm so used to saying it, really isn't what you want to say.
Right.
We're in transition with learning the language to discuss
committed
this, right?
Implies like committing a crime or committing a sin, and it's neither of those. It's
right.
It's death by suicide.
Exactly, yeah.
It's not committing. So I'm learning.
Yeah.
Trying.
My own therapist used that phrase a few weeks ago. And so even the mental health professionals are in transition and learning about how to talk about this, which is part of the process, right? And we're going to make some mistakes along the way. And I think that's part of what we learn about what it is to be human. And to be human is parts of a whole. And some of them aren't always pretty to our own eyes. And we're afraid that that'll make us look flawed in the eyes of the world. But it doesn't. That's what makes you human. And the more, you know, your family talks about your feelings, however weird you think they might be, it's not. That helps all of us. That helps all of us go home to our families and be able to say, hey, this wasn't a good day. And here's why. And it's the things that are hiding in the dark that seem so much scarier there than they are when you bring them out into the light.
Right.
And so that's what we're doing with these conversations. And, you know, Wayne being able to admit that and that you're a work in progress, like we all are, that's really valuable, too.
And you're so right about thoughts just being thoughts. Don't empower them with being fact. They're not fact. That's something that therapy taught me also. They're thoughts, and they're worth about nothing, usually.
Yeah. If you let them, you know, spiral into actions, that's why it's so important for all of us to slow down and to be in those moments and to, you know, learn how to take care of ourselves, learn how to listen to ourselves. And it is. I say all the time, work in progress.
Yeah.
Always. Mm-hmm. We all are.
And I think it's so important to just open up, you know, whether it be to friends, family, coaches, teachers, whoever it might be that you feel comfortable talking to, tell them. And I think you'd be surprised how many people might feel the same way as you or something similar. And, you know, you can connect on that and then get the help that you need. But when you have that feeling that you're all alone and it's just you that's feeling that way, you'd be surprised. It's really not.
Carly, you're a great sister.
Oh, thank you.
A sister to all of us, I would say.
And a wonderful human. And thank you so much for everything that you've shared today and for continuing to keep Madison's story alive and to inspire so many of us.
Thank you guys so much for having me.
If you want to get help right now, either for yourself or somebody you care about, here's what you can do. You can call the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline. Here's that number, 1-800-273-TALK. That works out to 1-800-273-8255. What else can you do, Christine?
You can go to imlistening.org for all kinds of resources and information, and you can use the hashtag imlistening to share your stories.
We hope this is helping, and we have something else we want to bring you right now. And since we recorded this next interview about first responders and the stress they face, it was really sad news to see we saw a 10th NYPD officer take his life this year just a few days ago.
And we know that it's not only police officers who have the unique challenge of dealing with trauma on the job in highly stressful, highly reactive situations.
It's first responders of all sorts who have to go to car accidents, shootings. It's military personnel. It's teachers, sadly, more and more. It's really all of us as time goes on.
This is I'm Listening New York.
I'm Wayne Cabot.
And I'm Christine Malavetz. I'm Listening aims to reduce the stigma of talking about mental illness and suicide by sharing our stories and our experiences.
And what does it tell you, Christine, that police are more likely to kill themselves than be killed? That is a sobering thing to hear. Among the general population, 13 out of every 100,000 of us will die by suicide. It's 17 out of 100,000 for police officers, which may not sound like a big leap in numbers, but if you think about it mathematically, it really is. And for some reason, it has gotten worse this year in New York City. 9 suicides as of last month compared to 4 or 5 in a typical year. 2 people trying to reverse this are here with us right now. They're with PAPA, which is police organization providing peer assistance, PAPA, and cops can get help that way. It's confidential. It's non-departmental, which I think is really important because officers often hear horror stories about colleagues who are deemed mentally unfit for duty and demoted, and they have their guns taken away. They're placed on desk jobs. So John Petrullo is here, the director of PAPA, and Dr. Frank Dowling, who's a psychiatrist at Stony Brook University Hospital. You say that every time a cop kicks a door down serving a warrant, even if nothing happens, it changes a person's brain psychology. What happens when a cop is in action? What is it unique about officers?
Yes. Thanks for asking that question. What happens is there's the obvious traumatic stress incidents when shots are fired or someone has to draw their firearm, think about firing it. Someone goes through a door and someone assaults them from the other side. But with each call, with each response, every time that officer is responding, that same stress response, our fight, flight, freeze response or adrenaline response, is all systems go. It's life-saving to keep you at absolute peak performance in a crisis. And the officer doesn't know what's going to happen until they get through the other side. There's many times where officers are stopping, you know, for example, a traffic stop. Most of the time, it's not that big a deal. But there are times when things could go awry. So depending on the officer's prior experiences, if they've had a couple of stops that were pretty serious, pretty dangerous, then every stop after that has a different meaning. Responding to domestic dispute calls, there's a violent situation, that's why there's a call, and it's very unpredictable the way things will go.
I'll tell you what really caught my attention when the police commissioner in New York City, James O'Neill, said, he used the word contagion, asking if there's some sort of contagion among police in New York City with what I think you'd have to describe as a rash of suicides this year. When you hear that word as a psychiatrist or psychologist, and I always confuse which is which, sorry, what does it tell you? Is that the correct word to use, and what does that mean?
Yes, I think it is the correct word, and I am a psychiatrist, so okay. I'm a physician who may diagnose and prescribe and also can do counseling or psychotherapy, and I do both. So with suicides, we've seen this with adolescent suicides in schools and colleges. We've seen it in certain town situations, and we do see it at times with law enforcement that if one kills themselves, then there could be others who may be depressed, may be struggling, may have thoughts of killing themselves. And now the unthinkable is now thinkable and very real
because someone
in their family has just done that.
Meaning police family.
Yes, and yeah. Meaning the police family. So, you know, there's 36,000 members of service in the NYPD. Most of them don't know each other, but they are a family. And if someone dies in the line of duty or dies by suicide, it affects every one of them. There could be someone else who may not even be at that point, but some stressors happen, and now the bottom drops out. It's in the air, if you will, so to speak. So we had 4 suicides in June from the 7th to the 28th. We hadn't seen anything like that since the 90s, and now we have 7 in about 10 weeks, 9 or 10 weeks. I would consider that a contagion or a cluster, and contagion almost like an infectious disease, even though it isn't literally that, but there's something that unfortunately is making the unthinkable too thinkable right now.
So let's bring this around to PAPA, which has existed since
1996.
So that's more than 2 decades of providing peer support for officers. And we are clearly in a crisis mode now, but PAPA exists so that hopefully we can avoid getting to this crisis point. What kind of programs does PAPA offer for officers?
The foundation of PAPA is the helpline, which is when a police officer reaches the point of being a little bit stressed out, or worse, they can call and speak to another cop. That cop is trained to be a good listener. They're not trained to be counselors. They're not trained to try to fix it for them. But what they do is let's talk cop to cop and then we'll sit down and we'll see if we can't get you to go into a mental health professional if that's needed. And that's where we enlist the services of Dr. Dowling and other clinicians. We have a panel of about 125 clinical personnel. We're constantly out there trying to speak to the police officers to encourage them that if they do feel the need to reach out, that they do, that it's safe, it's confidential. No information, again, we're separate from the department, so no information goes back to the department about any cop that calls for our services. We go out on any critical incident that happens. So when one of our police officers is involved in a shooting or responds to a suicide of a cop, or if one of our officers is seriously injured or killed in a police accident while driving, we'll dispatch a team out just to go and do a checkup with them, let them know what's available, let them know we have clinicians available if they need it. We've also instituted a program called ASSIST. It's a two-day training that gives the police officers the skills to identify somebody earlier on if they are walking down that road towards suicide.
How would you know if somebody's walking down that road?
Well, when we have conversations with them, there's usually signs that may be visible to them. All of a sudden, you know the baseline of the person. So this training would be to help them with their partners, a loved one, a family member, and you know that you're normally in a good mood, and all of a sudden your mood is changed. You want to go do something with them. Say you go and play golf with them every day or every other day, and now I don't want to go play golf. And the tone that they tell that to you in sounds very down. There's other signs where they give away possessions. If somebody's giving you something that you know is a prized possession, you may want to ask simple questions. Why are you giving me this? What's the reason for you giving this away? I know you love this. And I always use the example of a football I have that's signed by Joe Namath after the 69 Super Bowl. And to me, that's a cherished piece of memorabilia I have. And if I went to somebody and said, hey, I want you to have this football, I hope you would turn around and ask me, John, why? You love this. This is something that you cherish. Why would you give it to me? And when they put those what we call invitations out there, those invitations require a response. They're doing it to get somebody to say, hey, ask me why. I'm giving you this. At least give me the courtesy of a response to my invitation. And when the cops are in tune to that, they'll then ask why. And then what we found through our experience is the cop will say, you know, it may be something as simple as, well, I don't need it where I'm going, or I don't need it anymore. And then our questions can continue down that path. And it's something small, but it works. Many times we find that a cop would be very uncomfortable to ask somebody that uncomfortable question. They see all the signs. It's like, well, I don't know what I should do here. Should I ask it? Should I ignore it? So we encourage them to not ignore it. Make sure they ask the question. Ask it straight out and straightforward to them. And when they get to the point where they think the person may be suicidal, they'll then ask them directly, are you thinking of killing yourself or are you thinking of suicide?
Are people usually honest about that?
In my experience, yes, very honest. Sometimes you'll get a definite absolutely not, and they'll give you many reasons why, and it's a very convincing reason. But sometimes we also take a no answer as a yes, a silent answer as a yes, there's something going on. Sometimes they pause, and they don't answer right away. Well, we know then, okay, there's something here, and then we're going to encourage them to get into a mental health professional so that they can make that call.
John, you mentioned how uncomfortable these conversations can be, and you mentioned a few times how important it is for these officers to understand that what you provide is confidential. And with I'm Listening, what we're aiming to do is to reduce the stigma of talking about mental illness and suicide. How is that stigma especially a challenge for members of the NYPD?
Well, based on my experience from being a police officer, it's something that would be very uncomfortable. During my career, I don't know who I would have reached out to. And knowing that there's a group that's confidential, you're not reporting it back to the department, that would make me feel much better. Okay, I know there's a stigma involved, but you're going to keep it private. It's going to be confidential. Why it works so well with peers is we're going to trust each other. It's one cop telling another cop, no, listen, I know I'm familiar with PAPA. They have clinicians that have been trained by PAPA to understand first responder situations. And just being that segue, taking them from I'm nervous, I don't know if I should have ever made this call, to getting them into help, we see a dramatic turnaround once they get into the services and we keep in touch with them on a regular basis, how good they're doing and how comfortable they are.
So you were a cop, so you know, and Frank, you're a psychiatrist, you also would know the answer to this question, which is, we know cops have a reputation as being, you know, tough guys, or tough women. But especially men, I think, in this case, look at it as a sign of weakness to speak to anybody, whether it's confidential or not. And I think that might be true generally, but especially among police officers. So for anyone listening right now, what's the message? How do you dispel that stigma right now that it's not a sign of weakness?
That's a great question. And one of the messages Papa has over and over is that it's a sign of strength to get help, not weakness. But in our society as a whole, there's still stigma about mental health issues, depression, anxiety, traumatic stress, alcohol. And most people with any of those problems, even outside of law enforcement, are not getting any treatment at all. In law enforcement, these men and women, on average, are better at handling the situations they face than the rest of us. The problem is they're human. They're not really superhuman, even though they put that level of responsibility on themselves. They have a professional demeanor, so they do their job, and they keep their game face on, and they're hurting inside. And anyone else who's hurting does the same thing because they're all professionals, so they perceive that they're the only one. And they lose sight of the fact that even in this country as a whole, 1 in 6 at some time in their lives might have an episode of depression or anxiety where they could benefit from talking to someone at least, maybe an antidepressant. So with law enforcement, it's going to be the same or higher because of these repetitive, stressful situations, seeing the worst, you know, evil that one person can do to another, and it chips away at them over the years, and they expect themselves and misunderstand strength as being that it won't affect me, and we have to reframe that, and the peers are the best at doing that. No, strength is doing your job despite hurting. That's what strength is. Better strength is doing your job despite hurting, but recognizing you need a little extra help. And that's why it's great that we're meeting and then getting them to a person like me.
It's so important to reinforce that message with everyone, that sometimes what we think of as weakness, what we're afraid to bring out of the darkness into the light, is actually what unites us. And as you spoke about the NYPD being a family, sometimes we think that when we keep those darkest parts of ourselves from our families, we're protecting them. But in reality, that's not always the case. Do you think sometimes there are cases where we think protecting our family means keeping those things from them that might be scary, that might push them away, when in reality what Papa does is reinforce that's not weakness at all, that when we hide things, even the scary things about ourselves and the people we care about, we're actually not being honest with them.
Through, again, my experience with police officers, many don't want to bring the job home, which is hence where some of the problems start, because they don't speak to anybody about it. And with that, and I can understand why they don't want to bring it home. Outside of police personnel, many people wouldn't understand what you've seen or what you've just gone through, and they wouldn't even know how to react. I know sometimes during my career when I talked to somebody that was outside the department and share something with them, they were totally lost with it. They just didn't get it. So for me, it wouldn't be comfortable talking to, say, a family member, and I wouldn't want to burden them with that. But having the availability of a group that you can go to that's, again, all cops, they've been through many of the same situations, it makes it much more comfortable to be able to open up. We get cops that come in, and we'll sit. We have some cops that come in a group, and we get to talk to them. And some of them will come in, and we always keep a box of tissues in there. When you mention, you know, cops can't cry, they're macho. And if you give them the right place and the confidentiality, and they're comfortable in there, they will talk. And through that talking and opening up is when we use the tissues, because they will cry and they will be able to get it out in a comfortable place. And that makes all the difference.
They also do feel the responsibility to have each other's backs when they respond to situations. And I think along with that, they put the unfair burden on themselves that I'm not going to share this with my partner. They've got their own things to worry about. And again, with that professional demeanor, everyone else seems like they're okay. Am I the only one that's hurting? Am I failing? Am I weak? And one of the things I've had the privilege to do is be involved in various groups that are run by the peers. And as a psychiatrist, I may be a support person in that group. We've had it happen where we have eight officers who are coming because of a traumatic event, because of an officer suicide, and they're talking about that event, but they also might share, you know, this was really tough for me, especially after my sister lost the baby from SIDS a month ago, or, you know, my mother-in-law is going through chemotherapy and the prognosis is still unclear. And if their officers are from the same squad who were affected by that same event, they look at each other and go, you really have stuff going on too, so do I. Mm. So it reinforces exactly what we're saying, that they're human, they all have things. And in some ways, when you're responding during the crisis, pushing all these things aside to do what you got to do, as they say, is effective, but they've got to get back to it later on so it doesn't just sit there and fester and then hurt them later on. And then when they realize that they're all hurting, we're normalizing these events and then normalizing the next step to talk to someone.
Sounds like it's working. Sounds like from that anecdote, you guys are making progress. And yet then we see these numbers in New York City and wonder what's going on. You mentioned last time it was this intense in New York City for police officers taking their lives was back in the 90s. Are there parallels between now and then with police morale? Or, you know, we certainly had the very high-profile chokehold situation on Staten Island in which Officer Pantaleo was stripped of his gun and his badge and thrown off the force. Is there a connection there?
It's difficult to come up with any one answer of why we have this increase in suicides. I think it's going to turn out to be several reasons. In the 90s, when PAPA started, if you look at the 10 years before PAPA's inception, the suicide rate in the NYPD was more like 22 to 24 per 100,000. And after PAPA's inception from 96 going forward, it dropped to around 12 to 14 per 100,000. And we've seen a little bit of a creeping up towards 15 per 100,000, still much lower overall. But we've had some concerns. And I think 9/11 itself affected things in many ways. It normalized stress. Many were directly affected by it, but anybody who was on the NYPD certainly knew others who were affected by it. So it normalized stress and getting help. PAPA was
in a good way then.
In a good way, yeah. Yes. And PAPA was more visible because of outreaches that were done at the various sites to let people know we have their backs, Ground Zero, the morgue, the landfill, going to the commands. And for several years, there were 9/11 related grants that allowed us to do extra effort to be even more visible. We fast forward, maybe 5-6 years ago, we reach a point where most of the officers who served on 9/11 are retired, and now it's probably, I'm only guessing, I don't know the data specifically, 10 or 12% were on the job on 9/11. PAPA has been less visible, and I think people just aren't thinking of us when they can. And some of the problem there is if someone is struggling with depression or anxiety, traumatic stress, an alcohol problem, the worse their symptoms get, the more black and white and negative their thinking is. So the more challenging it is to overcome all these obstacles we're talking about to reach out at that time. So that's why we feel we need to find a way to do more outreaches, to be more visible, to train each other, to look out for their peers, because they'll be much more motivated to look out for their peers than themselves, but they may identify that peer in the mirror and still reach out.
So then what is the next step in the evolution of PAPA? What do you hope for as far as future programs or future types of outreach? Are there things on the table that you're hoping to be able to implement so that we can get ourselves out of this current crisis?
Something we just did recently, actually this was in May, before the start of the summer, we did an outreach to the police officers and their families. And what we did was we invited them to come and we set it up in a catering hall where they can come out, and we were offering them a meal when they come out, and we were giving them some specifics on suicide awareness, how to take better self-care and take care of themselves, how to cherish and nurture their relationships that they're in. So that was the next phase that we're in with this. We also had somebody come in to do what the department or the rank and file may not be ready for yet, but we introduced meditation as a way to try to give them an outlet to de-stress a little bit.
Some rank and file, not ready for that, huh? It's not very cop-like.
It's not when you said cops don't like to cry, and the
right.
macho, well, now the word meditation isn't yet ready to be received. But we did get a turnout, and cops came out there with their families and with their loved one. It didn't have to be whether it be a significant other, but it could have just been a family member, a child that came with them, a parent that came with some of the cops, just so that we can share ideas with them of what it's like to be a cop and how it may be different than how they perceive it to be, and why a cop may come home and say, you know, maybe I just need a half hour downstairs to sit and just listen to music. And they come home and it's like, well, let's do this. We have to do that. And we're trying to get them to join together so that they can understand why a cop may come home and say, I need a little bit of downtime. And with that, we did a piece, and we were using some of the love languages as well from the book, The Love Languages, The Five Languages. And again, we're going to try to increase our outreaches with that. It's our hope in the future by the end of the fall, early winter, to have this program up in all the boroughs. We did it in Staten Island is where we targeted. So all the cops who lived on Staten Island got a mailing. We were hoping that the spouses or the significant others would open it up and say, hey, what is this? So the cop wouldn't just put it aside and said, I don't want to do this. Maybe their loved one would say, no, I think we should go to this. And they learned some good skills.
Love it. Spirituality. That's a fine idea. And on top of that, and Dr. Dowling, you can talk about prescriptions that can help people. But with a cop, it's tough, right? Because there are certain things cops cannot be on because it slows their responses. I'm thinking about maybe Xanax, right? Anti-anxiety medications. Is that something that cops cannot be on?
So the question about medications is a good one. And from a medical perspective, what I'll say is is, for one thing, with many of the issues they deal with, psychotherapy, talking to someone, works. And if we look at traumatic stress, anxiety, depression, it works. There are times where someone may have, you know, significant enough symptoms that medications are needed, and antidepressants medically are generally very safe. We always have to tailor them to the individual person, their history. Benzodiazepines, so something in the Xanax, Ativan, Valium family, the way I would put it is they can sometimes impair your psychomotor performance. So if you're just a doc sitting in an office like me and you were on such a medication, it's probably not a big deal. But if you're a pilot, if you're military, if you're law enforcement, in any second, you could be in the middle of a very dangerous situation. They probably shouldn't be used, or should be used, I'll say, sparingly and carefully, because we don't want something that could interfere with their psychomotor performance. Even among antidepressants, sometimes they can be sedating. They can make someone feel cognitively fuzzy or foggy. I'm much more aware and talking with my patients who are in a high-risk profession like law enforcement, firefighter, pilot, you know, that they need to be more careful and we need to be monitoring side effects together. But there's so many options these days that in partnering with someone to figure it out, a good doc and an officer who's willing to get help and wanting to get help, and get back to being more like their regular selves, where they're much more effective on the medication than they were off, we can usually find that balancing act of, you know, minimal side effects that interfere, but improvement in how they're doing.
So for any officer or friend, family member, or loved one of an officer who may be listening to our I'm Listening conversation right now, how do they get in touch with PAPA to connect themselves or the people they love to your resources?
We have many ways for them to get in touch with us. The main one is through our hotline. We have a hotline set up. It's 1-800-COPS-COP. It also is 1-888-COPS-COP. And the police officer can call and they'll speak to another police officer on the other end of the line. And that starts our whole process. There are other ways to get them. We have outreaches we do. They can come right up to one of our peers and get it started that way, which we have had, and one that I'm very happy about, and was earlier in this year. We had one officer who met with us at one of our outreaches, and to one of our peers, he says, listen, I'm not doing well. I'm thinking I might want to kill myself. And from that outreach, we were able to right there get him taken care of, get him into services. And now, all these months later, he is back to full duty, doing very well.
Fantastic.
And the department doesn't get information on that as to what's going on with the person. And that was just, when we get those stories, I love to share them because it just keeps even the peers motivated to keep doing what we do because this stuff works and it does save lives.
When we look at suicide prevention, there's two areas we can look at. One is when an officer is down in the rabbit hole, unfortunately, and really miserable, wishing they weren't alive and starting to think about doing something. We always want to help that person, and sometimes Pop has been able to talk someone off the ledge, so to speak, and save that life. But I think in some ways more important, or where we can save more officers, and I think this will work outside of law enforcement too, is people getting help earlier, way before it gets to that point. So people need to understand depression, anxiety, traumatic stress, alcohol abuse, which is often medicating depression, anxiety, stress-related symptoms, other issues, is these are all very treatable. And the earlier someone comes in, the easier it is to treat with various types of talk therapy or psychotherapy, depending on the condition and what fits that person and their skill set, and then antidepressants or other medications when they're appropriate. So we can't measure individually who did we save, so to speak.
Right.
We likely can reduce suicides there. So in my view, at least one in three law enforcement officers in the NYPD by the time they retire is going to have at least one episode, if not persistent, issues with depression, anxiety, traumatic stress, where they really should. They could benefit from getting help. There's probably 6,000 officers who could benefit from help right now. I'm not saying they'll all be suicidal, but if they all got help, or even half of them got help, we'd see a great reduction in the suicide. So looking at it from both angles is important. Getting the help early when there is a condition, but preventing the suicide as well as saving someone when they really are at that point.
Well, and we're all familiar with the concept of an annual physical, and I'm sure that police officers have to go through a stricter regimen than most of us to be able to do the physical aspects of their job. One of the aims of a program, an initiative, like I'm listening, is to understand that just as you take preventative care of your body, taking preventative care of your mental health is equally as important. Taking the time to slow down and identify how you're feeling, especially in such a high stress, high paced, incredibly at times overwhelming profession. The mindfulness, the meditation, the ability to say, this is what I need right now to slow down in a world that goes so quickly. That's invaluable.
Absolutely. The one thing I want to add to that is moral injury. This is a concept that people have started to talk about with our military service members coming home since 2001. There's traumatic stress and they face difficult things. They may have had to make choices. They've witnessed things that are some, you know, terrible things to deal with and to reconcile morally, even if they were the correct decision that they had to take a life to save a life. That happens with officers every day and where they go with that. And that's another area to look at. Sometimes it's spiritual counseling, going to their minister, their rabbi, their pastor. But sometimes that's also talking to someone, a professional who understands that there's the clinical stuff, so to speak, the checklist of symptoms, and then there's this moral injury of how do I reconcile these situations I've been involved in or I've witnessed and try to keep my head up high and still have faith in people.
John Petrullo, Dr. Frank Dowling, PAPA, P-O-P-P-A. If you search P-O-P-P-A, it'll all pop up.
Yes, there's a website, PAPA New York, and all of our information on PAPA and contact information and programs will be listed there.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
If you're coping with stress, if you're feeling like you may be at the point of self-harm, or you're noticing changes in people you love that have you feeling concerned, we're hoping that I'm Listening can help. The National Suicide Prevention Lifeline is 1-800-273-TALK. So that's 1-800-273-8255. You can go to imlistening.org for resources and information. And please use the hashtag #I'mListening to share your stories, because the more we share our stories, the more connected we all are, and the more lives we can save.
I'm going to put you on the spot. Is there something you want to share? Anything about your experiences? Something you've taken away from maybe these last couple of hours?
I mean, I have dealt with depression, anxiety, panic attacks, all kinds of things since I was a teenager. I tell everyone at work, everyone knows, I have a standing therapy appointment on Wednesdays. I have to leave work early on Wednesdays.
Is that where you go on Wednesdays?
Because
I thought you were going drinking.
I don't even drink. But it's important to me to be able to talk about going to therapy in the same way you would talk about going to the doctor. Because as we talked about,
it's normal.
It's normal.
Yep.
To take proactive steps towards maintaining your mental health is just as important as your physical health. And I mean, it's been a really long journey for me, and every conversation I have with coworkers, friends, family about what I've gone through, about what I've learned, I feel like it makes a difference. These conversations don't have to be scary or overwhelming or something we do once a year. This is a lifetime commitment to reducing the stigma of talking about mental health and suicide prevention. It's something that we talked about this earlier too, so I know I'm repeating myself, but when you take scary things out of the darkness, out of the shadows, and you bring them into the light, they become a lot less scary.
It's part of our own personal evolution and part of society's evolution to be able to, this is how we're evolving, by being able to talk about these things. And I just remember growing up, it was shameful. Nobody talked about any of this, and the problems didn't go away magically. Imagine that. And we're hoping this is certainly going to help. I tell you something else that really grabbed me when we were hearing the people from Papa talk about some of the signs that maybe someone is looking to end their life. I had a news anchor I worked with here on WCBS News Radio in 1992, Tom Franklin. I mean, he was a hero of mine. A fantastic man, a fantastic broadcaster, just the best there ever was, a rock, a pillar. And he ended his life, and we were devastated. And now I think back and I realize, you know what? He had been giving us things the last couple of weeks before he took his life. He had given me this beautiful wooden plaque with a gold-plated world map on it, because he knew I was into maps. My dad was a cigar smoker. He was a cigar smoker. He gave all of his cigars. He said, "Give these to your dad." I just thought he was being nice, and maybe he was, but now looking back, it's easy to see these signs in the rearview mirror, so hopefully now we will see them going forward.
Because you can't... It's hard to see the whole picture when you're in it, both when you're in it, when you're in that dark place, or when someone you know is. I've lost 3 friends and colleagues, all of the men, in the last year.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
I'm sorry for your loss of Tom, too. It's never easy to deal with as a survivor of loss, or obviously as someone who's going through it. But what we're hoping to do with I'm Listening is make it easier for you to find resources and guidelines so that you can observe these changes both in yourself and others. And we're all more aware and we're all more cognizant of what we can do to help each other.
Proud of our company for doing this. I see Entercom's Chief Programming Officer Pat Paxton says if we can help just one person, our time will have been well spent. I think our time was well spent. Christine, thank you.
Thank you, Wayne.